We look back at 2023, a big budget session, the governor's race, plus the abortion ban in the courts, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 22nd, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, we look back at the 2023 legislative session, which delivered major new investments in public and mental health and created near universal access to private school vouchers. Much of the debate in the 2023 session focused not just on policy, but on dollars. Lawmakers dramatically expanded the services local health departments could offer and allotted $225 million for that effort. They invested in local community mental health centers, a 988 crisis response line, and getting people out of jail and into treatment, spending $100 million. And a $1.5 billion increase for K-12 education included a dramatic expansion of the state's school voucher program, allowing families of four earning up to $220,000 a year to access taxpayer dollars for private school education.
Was the spending spree a surprise? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwarz, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, were you surprised that lawmakers spent so big in 2023?
There was so much money, okay, and there was so much pent-up need based on the statistics for public health and mental health in this state that there was no excuse for them not to do something. And they did something. But I frankly think that the former Senator Kenley's involvement in that really helped persuade Republicans that it was way past time to start investment in public and mental health. And they've done a good first step. I mean, they're not there yet by any means, but they've done a good first step. But the voucher program makes no sense. I mean, it makes no sense. People already had their kids in private schools and were already paying for that education. And now we've thrown money at that and at charters, and taken away from traditional public education, where 90% of the students are, and we've seen what's happened. Third grade failures in reading, and nobody else, or the numbers going to higher education going down. Their whole experiment in privatizing public education has been a failure, and they will not admit it. And that's really unfortunate.
Well, this kind of leads to what I wanted to ask you about, which is it feels like with those big investments that they made in public health and mental health and in basically universal, near universal vouchers, these are all investments that you really can't back away from.
Right,
you
right.
have to just keep going now, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, and they knew that going in. But I think like having years of, and hopefully it's sustained because we had these bizarre COVID years, we had a lot of federal money coming into the state. We had inflation. Government makes more money on it. When inflation's high, everything costs more, obviously. So you're pulling
you're
more tax revenue.
Tax, right.
You know, so once inflation, as it is now, close to kind of right-sizing, or at least on that path, you hope like the investments can be maintained. But I think we've seen such an increase in tax revenue in part because of economic investment in the state of Indiana. It's kind of two sides of a coin. You're spending more money, but you're spending historic amounts of revenue.
You need a new adjective, okay? A dollar more.
But you're also historically bringing in higher wage jobs. Right. The state's breaking those records every year in outside investment and new and economic development. And so you're building the economy as spending's keeping up in the areas where Republicans have wanted to focus it.
John, is there so of these three big investments, vouchers, public health, and mental health, long term, and I don't mean like 5 years from now, I mean 20 years from now, as people look back on the 2023 session, which do you think they will say made the biggest impact?
Well, part of our problem with our political system now is nobody's looking ahead 20 years. I mean, we're looking ahead to the next election or the next, you know, biennial budget. So let's stipulate that. I think clearly their need was mental health and access to mental health care. And we did see movement in those areas. I mean, it's just a crisis. It's a crisis in Indiana. It's a crisis everywhere in the country. It's probably a crisis everywhere on the planet. And good for them for doing something. It wasn't what had been sought, but it was something.
And even, more on the mental health side than the public health side, I think the people most directly involved said, this is a good start, but we really need way need more.
We also had more universal support, maybe not for the original ask, but public health funding got caught up in this notion of public health is, you know, big government trying to tell locals how to do what they need to offer.
And blow back to COVID policies.
Yeah, I mean, there was that baggage, which it didn't really affect the other. I'd say in terms of the surprises to your question, I would have been surprised certainly 5 years ago if you told me that this money would have been available, but no one saw the pandemic coming. The other surprise maybe isn't what was spent, but what wasn't spent. You had the coffers were flush with cash, but we still didn't see funding, that extra check for retirees, for the state employees. Again, that's a small amount. Yeah. But you would think if you're throwing money at anything that moves, that would have been a logical step. Or you look at child care, where there was an increase. It's not nearly the threshold for instance, vouchers.
Right.
What is it now, 400% of,
yep.
of
mm-hmm.
free
poverty.
Lunch or poverty? And this moved up a little bit, but it wasn't funded fully. So if anything, I'm more surprised by what wasn't funded.
We talked about sort of the big three spending items, but how else did you think of the 2023 session? What stood out in your mind?
Well, it seems so long ago now, I had to go look it up.
Oh, yeah, I had to totally look at my old stories for this.
I mean, they did help parents by getting rid of K-12 textbook fees. They gave almost $1 billion to the IEDC for unfettered economic development spending, and we're starting to see that in every meeting where they're spending more and more of it to entice companies. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of pushback on that sort of subject. We also saw some culture war issues with transgender healthcare ban and pronoun usage and library books. So they did a lot.
Yeah, it was a big session. All right, Indiana's 2024 gubernatorial race was fully in gear throughout 2023 as the Republican field expanded and Democrats seemingly found their candidate.
Indiana has its first open governor's race since 2012, and the Republican field has attracted some prominent names and deep pockets. Businessman Eric Doden has been in the race for more than 2 years, while Jamie Rittenour filed in April of last year. Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch and U.S. Senator Mike Braun joined just before the calendar flipped to 2023. Former Attorney General Curtis Hill threw his hat into the ring this summer, while former State Commerce Secretary Brad Chambers entered the field about a month later. On the Democrat side, former State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick, who served in that office as a Republican, announced her candidacy and is the presumptive favorite to earn the party's nomination.
Mike O'Brien, what surprised you the most about the governor's race this year?
I think how unchanged it is. We had Eric Doden running for 2.5 years. We've got this kind of large field, and we've got Mike Braun in the lead, endorsed by Donald Trump. And we're still all kind of waiting to see what breaks the Trump hold on the party, right? Whether that's in the presidential primary with the Iowa caucus coming up, and then what is the impact downstream for candidates that he's impacted? The answer might be nothing. It may be that it none of it changes, that Donald Trump has just been the head of the party now since 2015, and he will continue to be the head of the party in 2015, and whoever has tied themselves to that program is going to be rewarded politically. So it's hard to see.
At least in primary elections,
certainly. So it's hard to see. It's hard to predict what's going to break this race open, other than they all start going at each other.
Yeah, are you a little surprised we haven't seen more sniping at each other from the candidates?
They've started sniping.
A little bit.
You know what's really surprising about this is it used to be that the lieutenant governor was the heir apparent to the gubernatorial nomination from Frank O'Bannon and Joe Kernan and even Eric Holcomb. The only difference here is that the lieutenant governor's a woman.
Come on.
That happens to be the truth.
That's a reach.
Well, but that
but
wasn't...
I actually think Suzanne's got a pretty unique lane here that she can occupy.
Oh, I do, too. I've said that before.
We've got three or four guys competing for the same vote.
But not because the Republican Party in its vast majority is prepared to nominate a woman for governor, but she does have a section of the Republican
I think there's
vote.
More to that than you talk...
Oh, yeah.
I think there's less of that than you think there is.
I don't think so.
I don't hear it at all.
You always try to control women. I mean, you do. I mean, from the abortion question on down.
I've spent a whole life wife not trying to control women.
This is from the first woman ever to be nominated by a major party for lieutenant governor in this state.
Anyway,
I know that is one of the things
that is surprising. and the sniping starting, and, you know, I know you keep saying that Braun is ahead, and supposedly he has numbers for that, but if you were ahead as much as he's supposed to be, why are you attacking Doden?
To stay ahead.
Because he's a threat?
You don't stay ahead by sitting
he's
around.
The threat?
I think the name that got into the race this year that I think surprised a lot of people was Brad Chambers.
Yeah.
Never run for political office before. He'd been the Secretary of Commerce for a couple of years. Hadn't been a big political name as far as I could tell. But is he the one that could have the biggest impact on this race when we come down to it next May?
Possibly, and he's got money, obviously, to put into the race, and he doesn't even really have to go to the fundraising well, though he is. He's bringing in large contributions from supporters, some of which have him to thank for incentives and projects from the IEDC when he was there. I think the biggest surprise is how soon it started, like in earnest, and how I am a little shocked that at least one or two haven't dropped out yet. We'll see in January if they can all come up with, you know,
the signatures.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. So the deadline is, I think, early February for the signatures.
Yeah.
So you have to get 500 signatures of voter signatures from each, registered voter signatures from each of the 9 congressional districts, 4,500 signatures.
And that is tough.
That is a high bar.
You've got to certify them at the county level. It's a process.
Right.
But these candidates
Do you think those, the five that we considered the most likely to potentially get this nomination?
And Jennifer McCormick.
Well, on the Republican side. Do you think all five of them get the signatures on the ballot?
I don't think. If you can't get that, yes, it's a lot of signatures. But if you can't get that, that shows you have no organizational strength at the grassroots level across the state, which you arguably need to mount a serious, legitimate gubernatorial campaign.
Which will matter in this
and not
campaign.
Enough money. I don't think that'll be the impediment. You know, as I've said before, I think what's interesting about that primary shaping up is just it's the... They've got to figure out how to differentiate themselves. We've talked about this. And the notion of traditional Republicanism versus popularism is, to me, what is most striking. Not surprising, but most striking. And I think that, if we watch that, that's where this really gets heated. It's not, that's the flashpoint in this, right? Because you do have people who represent traditional job creation, which is, you know, we're going to make some deals, we're going to get... national, international investors were going to come and create jobs. And then there are other people who say, you know, maybe that's not, jobs aren't always good if these deals are done behind closed doors, or if they're, heaven forbid, only in certain areas of the state that are already flush with jobs. I mean, I'm not arguing that point myself, but that's certainly a contention of those in perhaps some of the rural areas.
And as we've said before on the show, let's say the field is 5 or 6 people wide, you don't need more than like 25%
of the vote
to be the nominee. All right. The Indiana Supreme Court ruled this year that the state's near total abortion ban does not violate the Indiana Constitution. And since the ban took effect, abortions in the state have dropped to nearly single digits.
The court's 4-1 ruling said that the Constitution's liberty guarantee only applies to abortions that preserve a pregnant person's life or health. The ban only allows abortions if the pregnant person's serious health or life is at risk, if there's a lethal fetal anomaly, up to 20 weeks, and in cases of rape or incest, but only up to 10 weeks. But there are still ongoing lawsuits. One challenges the ban from a religious freedom perspective, the other seeks to broaden the serious health exception.
John Schwanitz, do you think that this has played out this year the way anti-abortion activists had long hoped?
I'm sure there was some consternation early on with some of the injunctions that were issued at the county court level, various courts, in fact, and some are still pending, I guess, in terms of the questions about the religious implications of this and the impact on the ability of individuals whose religions say that abortion should be the purview of mothers and women. That it's an affront to their religion. So that still will wind its way through the court system. As for where things stand now, despite some of those, what opponents of abortion would say would have been bumps in the road, I guess we're kind of where activists hoped we would be and where they thought we would be. I mean, you can read a lot of interesting things into the court about, you know, the acknowledgement on the court that there are aspects of that are protected, that that in fact a woman, if her life is in danger or serious threat, I don't think anybody had ever suggested in a formal fashion that the Indiana Constitution does explicitly guarantee that. So, again, if you want to get into the fine points, that was a news development in and of itself. Now, that's still 4-1 against, but...
Yeah. I think there were some people who thought after the U.S. Supreme Court ended the guarantees in Roe and Casey and sent it all back to the states, I think there were some people who thought, well, the legislature will pass its law, the court will say, and then if the court says that's fine, that's constitutional, we'll be done, it'll be over, it won't be at least...
Who thought that?
There were some who thought that,
oh, sure,
that would end the conversation. We are way far away from that still, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, with the amended complaint, they're now zeroing in closer on things like, are the medical exceptions and the health exceptions, you know, self-explained, too narrow. And also, we have these exceptions, but access, because of how they took away anything but a hospital, you know, the access issue, whether that's a burden for someone who even meets an exception, is still yet to be decided. So while the overall law was found constitutional, we still have a lot of room around the edges that we'll see discussion on.
And in states where we can have the voters actually speak, they will peel those restrictions back and allow access for a broader definition of who is eligible for abortion.
Well, to that point, we saw, you know, the abortion ban itself passed in 2022. And so we had the 2022 elections, not the primary, but the election,
yeah,
the general election.
But it hadn't taken effect
yet. So this would be the first, in 2024, that would be the first elections in which Indiana's near-total abortion ban is actually in effect.
Right.
But are we too far away from it, the law passing and then even the court okaying it, to have that much of an impact on our elections?
I think you're going to have it happen a whole variety of different ways. The Texas case, for example, is stirring up interest. If the Supreme Court deals with the drug that the FDA approved...
Well, it is going to do. It took up the case, depending on
their
outcome.
2 decades ago, depending on the outcome of that, what happened here is that the court and the anti-choice advocates are ahead of the public. The public does not agree with a total ban on abortion. They don't. They think there should be a number of exceptions, and it ought to be more readily available and more affordable. And the fact that they've crammed their religious belief down the throats of everyday Hoosiers is going to come back to bite them.
I don't think it'll have a broad impact on the state house races next year because the districts are pretty red in most places. But we've seen retirements from incumbent Republican lawmakers in the donut counties, particularly in Hamilton County so far, with both Donna Shibley and Jerry Torr retiring after long careers. Could abortion be a factor in those races?
I think in a very narrow race, in a Carmel general election. But remember, I'm still, I don't know about cash. That district's unwinnable, I think, for you. Maybe, right? Theoretically. But it's all been theoretical now for like three cycles where we've said the donuts are getting purple. Oh, they're going to flip. We're going to flip. The Democrats are going to flip this seat or that seat. And it's not happening. And it didn't happen. I don't understand the idea that like the time to really pounce on this or that voters were going to react to it wasn't immediately after it happening. When they had the chance last year, when it was decided,
that was not a general election, though.
Yes, it was.
It was in 2022.
But it wasn't a presidential election, and that's where triggers.
But that's where the lawmakers
were. I'm willing to be convinced,
up.
But like there is no evidence that's happening.
Well, see what happens after November.
But I agree with you that voters generally like, and I think part of that is because of our political system in Indiana, because we don't have referenda, right? We aren't running campaigns on abortion. Maybe it makes a marginal difference in a non-gerrymandered district. Like,
but there are not many of those.
Because there's so many Republicans and so many Hoosiers that are pro-life. That's why the outcome is
a lot of voters.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I'm not sure that people say that a 10-year-old should bear a child. I don't think that's true.
Or that a woman should risk her life to carry a fetus that's not viable.
When
you phrase it as dramatically as possible, of course most people aren't going to respond to that.
Well, that's not what our law does, though.
I understand.
A lot of voters don't even understand who to blame, if they're upset. Not the viewers and listeners of this show. That's a savvy group. But a lot of people don't know whether to blame the Supreme Court, Congress, state. They don't. I mean, so I blame voters for not being better educated about what they can impact. They can't have
just playing out the way it played out 50 years ago. Like, we are going to spend the next 50 years doing exactly what we did the last 50, which is trying to poke holes in it. The Texas case, where they rule around law and allow that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is
just,
we're just on, it just
it's
happens
just
and now, it's just flipped.
The flip side of the coin. All right. Well, there was, speaking of chaos, I suppose, there was chaos in the U.S. House multiple times this year as Republicans with a narrow majority grappled with who should be Speaker.
It started in January as Kevin McCarthy took a record 15 ballots to finally secure enough support to become Speaker of the House. But his tenure ended after only 9 months as McCarthy's decision to work with Democrats to avert a government shutdown led to his ouster. 3 weeks and four candidates later, the House finally had its new leader, Mike Johnson, a relative unknown at the national level.
Nikki Kelly, how much damage did House Republicans do to themselves this year with their leadership fights?
I think of the damage there is, they did it all to themselves. the Speaker fight from the beginning of trying to elect
McCarthy
to oust
him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was just a mess the whole time. So I definitely, for instance, I think that will have more of an impact than I think abortion will in the coming election cycle, especially when we get back after the holidays and see what they do on the debt ceiling issue. They basically just kicked it down the road. Yeah. Although I note that they gave Mike Johnson a lot more leeway on that than they did Kevin McCarthy.
To that end, let's say for the sake of argument that Mike Johnson is still the Speaker of the House and leader of the Republican caucus by the time we get to next November. Will all of the chaos of this year be far enough away in voters' minds that Republicans could get beyond any maybe short-term damage they might have caused themselves?
I don't think that the current alignment lends itself to getting past anything. I think that this is just the new normal, to employ the cliche. And I think that we will see this infighting and this sort of lack of ability on the part of leadership to bring people to the table. This is just going to happen over and over and over, sadly.
Just not dissimilarly from the Indiana House and Senate, the U.S. House, its most districts are either very Republican or very Democrat, but there are, and clearly, enough to swing the majority because mm-hmm. it's so narrow in one way or the other. Are Republicans in those districts, should they be worried about what just went on over these 12 months?
I don't think this will affect the outcome, but I think Democrats will be in the same. I think this is just where we are in American politics. I think like the chaos that we saw for Republicans in the House just happened to be because they were in charge. I think Democrats have that same problem, and when we've seen that. I mean, and part of that is just the U.S. House of Representatives is just like a microcosm of like extreme politics. And we have really blue seats.
But Nancy Pelosi won't. She led the House more easily with narrow majorities.
As did John Boehner and these guys in the past.
Nancy Pelosi is not going to be Speaker of the House anymore.
She's not the Speaker. On the other hand, the Republicans have aptly demonstrated that they are incapable of governing. This problem is not going to go away. The radical right caucus in their caucus in
which
the House.
Which is admittedly not very large.
But they've managed to control the agenda, and they think that compromise and working together for the good of the country is evil.
I think
and
from an institutional standpoint, we're crossing a lot of institutional lines that we would cross once in a generation, if that.
Right.
Impeach, I mean, we're never going to have another president we don't impeach.
Yeah.
Like, if they don't control the Congress.
Well, we still have presidents, though, do you think?
Yeah.
All right. Finally, as you look back at 2023, it doesn't matter. Time has no meaning. Who is your biggest winner in the Hoosier political scene? We'll start with you, Mike O'Brien.
You know, everyone was shocked by vouchers, universal vouchers. That has been a priority for Todd Houston since the days of Mitch Daniels and Tony Bennett when he was chief of staff. And he got what he had wanted for years. So people should not have been surprised at all that we have universal vouchers in Indiana.
And I'll add on Bob Boehning to that.
Bob Boehning, too.
Who's been working on that for as long as
Even longer than Todd Houston.
Yeah, arguably longer than Todd Houston. Who's your biggest winner?
I would give it to Democratic candidates for mayor in cities in Indiana. In all the population areas, we now have Democrats. We either reelected incumbents for the third or the fourth time, or we had victories in Terre Haute and in Evansville and in Elkhart. They didn't even put up a candidate against him.
That surprised me about Elkhart, which seems like a very red county, but a little
A blue dot.
It's like Fort Wayne, right? It's just you can't.
Yeah.
Can't beat John Henry.
Biggest winner, Nikki Kelly.
I got to give it to Governor Holcomb. I think he got pretty much everything on his agenda, from health funding to mental health to, you know, some raises for troopers. I mean, he just got everything on his agenda.
That's a good one. Against the headwind, too.
Yeah.
Post-COVID headwind. And also, just to have something different, how about Joe Hogsett? I mean, he ran against a very well-financed candidate who outspent him by millions of dollars and yet won by 20 points.
And then anytime you're running for a third term, that's
sure.
always
it's
a trigger.
Always tricky.
I'm with you. I think Governor Holcomb, he had a huge agenda and accomplished pretty much all of it. All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.